Even the most experienced hikers will encounter the occasional obstacle, but none of us ever expect to be stopped by armed soldiers and taken into custody. Yet that's what happened to three American hikers a few years back. You probably remember the story of the hikers captured in Iran and accused of spying. They wrote a book about their odyssey called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. Shane Bauer, Joshua Fatale, and Shara Short are the authors. Joshua Fatale is our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange today. He's an activist and organizer, largely focused on sustainable development. He graduated from UC Berkeley's program on environmental economics and policy and is now working on an advanced degree at New York University. And he lives in Brooklyn, is our guest here today. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
I understand there's an Oregon connection. You did some of your community organizing in Oregon. Where and when?
Well, my first introduction to the West Coast was actually in Northern California, Southern Oregon, and I was up there and hiking in the Siskiyouks, and I also was helping a friend doing some milling in southern Oregon outside of Ashland. And then I moved to Cottage Grove, Oregon in 2005, and I lived there really up until I went abroad and got detained. I was living in Cottage Grove working at an environmental education center outside of town there named Aprovecho.
All right. Aprovecho. We've had them on here a couple of times as well to talk about the programs they do.
Excellent.
All right. Good stuff. So the first question that anybody asks, obviously, is why did you and Shane and Sarah go where you went?
It's a great question. I was one that I kind of tormented over in solitary confinement for several months and definitely tormented over for the months after that in prison. And you know, I was working for about 6 months on a study abroad program where American students were. I took American students to Switzerland, India, China, and South Africa. And it was a one-semester program, and I was working as a teaching assistant on it in 2009. And when it ended, I went and visited a couple friends of mine who were living and working in Damascus, Syria. At the time, it was a safe place, and it was really a gorgeous place. I just was there about a week when they suggested we go to Iraqi Kurdistan. And you know, I actually met a guy, an American guy who had just come back from there, and they were assuring me it was safe. So I didn't really hesitate with that. And it was. It was beautiful. It was safe, and it was fine. But then when we got there, we thought, you know, it was nice. It was in the cities, but we wanted to get out of the cities and go out hiking, which we had heard about. And when we asked the guy at the hotel where to go, he suggested this waterfall, Amidawa, which is where I went. And then from there, there was, like, tons of families. It was, like, this touristy spot. But I went, me and Shane and Sarah, we were sort of zealous people, I guess, and we just hiked up beyond the waterfall, which little did we know ended up being the border of Iran and Iraq. You know, when we got near there, we didn't – there were no signs. There was no, you know, wall or anything like that. So we just actually, it took until we were kind of heading towards a ridge, and as we got really close to that ridge, we saw someone on the ridge where we were heading. But
not somebody who looked like a hiker, I gather.
No, he had a gun, so we listened to him when he waved us forward, and then when we got there, he, you know, there was such cognitive dissonance, such this notion that we didn't even realize how close we were, that when the guy asked, "Do we speak Farsi?" Shane thought that he said. One of my friends, he said, "Oh, we don't speak French." And I said, "No, Shane, he didn't ask French. He said Farsi." And I looked at the guy's uniform, and he had an Iranian flag on it, on his lapel. And that's when we realized we are in the wrong spot. And you know,
absolutely. It's an interesting moment, though. It's almost laughable until you get to the things that come later. That he says, "No, not Faransi, Farsi."
Exactly.
Yeah, big difference. Now, Shane, and I should point out that the book is written in such a way so that there's a Sarah section followed by a Shane section followed by a Josh section, and sometimes Shane and Sarah writing together. And Shane writes about you that you in particular had been rather reluctant to come to this part of the world. What was that about?
Well, it wasn't that I was reluctant. It was just that it was, you know, he had gone a few times, and me and him were buddies from undergraduate school, and I had gone to, when, there was one time in particular when I was in visiting my family in Israel when he was in Yemen, and he was kind of encouraging me to go, but it just didn't logistically work out. He had been sort of encouraging me to come to the Arab world for a long time, because I had been to the Middle East several times, because half my family is in Israel, and so I'd gone and visited them, but I'd never gone to the Middle East and gone to the Arab world until that trip to Syria.
All right, we're talking to Josh Fatale about his trip to Iran, his unintended trip to Iran, with his friends Shane Bauer and Sarah Shord. The book that they wrote together is called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. We'll talk more with Josh after a break and take some of your phone calls and emails as well if you'd like to join us. Also want to remind you, it is Spring Fund Drive 2014 here on all the services of Jefferson Public Radio. The total goal for all three services together is $200,000 in pledges. At the moment, we stand $15 short of $33,000. So you can give a $15 pledge and get to that next rung on the ladder. Many rungs yet to go, many days left in the campaign, but calling sooner is better than later. 888-552-6191, 888-552-6191, or pledge online at ijpr.org. Back on the exchange with Josh Fatale in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Joshua Fatale, one of the three American hikers imprisoned in Iran back in 2009. Shane Bauer and Sarah Shord were the others. Together, they've written a book about their experiences called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. Josh Fatale, our guest here on the Exchange, and you can join us in this conversation. Our phone number, our lone phone number today, 541-552-6782. That's a local call for the folks in Jackson and Josephine counties, a distance call for the others, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned thinking that Iraqi Kurdistan was going to be among the safest places you could travel to in the Middle East if you're going to do a trip like this. What is it that makes Iraqi Kurdistan so much safer, at least in perception, than the other places you could have gone?
Well, it's a, you know, Iraqi Kurdistan is like an autonomous region of Iraq. It had, even since 91, it's had its own government separate from Saddam. Of course, this was 2009, so it was post-Saddam, but they have a separate government even today that kind of runs its own affairs. The U.S. war in Iraq didn't take place in the north. It took place in the south or south of Iraqi Kurdistan. So Iraqi Kurdistan has this kind of, you know, I remember the hotel we were staying, there were Europeans and other people. And even while I was in prison, I remember smiling at learning from a letter that Iraqi Kurdistan made the list of New York Times top 41 places to visit while I was in prison. So it is, you know, people hear Iraq and they're like, well, you know, that's obvious, that's a war zone. But the Kurdistan region is actually like a totally distinct place.
And therefore somewhat protected from some of the events going on in the rest of Iraq. You point out in the book, Josh, that the three of you, you, Shane, and Sarah, could easily have been four. Who was the other member of your party, and why wasn't he with you that day?
well, we traveled to Iraqi Kurdistan. There were four of us. But this one guy, Sean, who was with us, he is less of an outdoorsy type. He was also a little bit under the weather. So he stayed back in the city we were in before we went hiking, in Sulaymaniyah. And we were about to turn around and like get back to go meet up with Sean when we got arrested. But there was, you know, he was luckily ill that day.
In fact, you had just talked to him on the phone, it sounds like, not very long before you'd been captured.
Yeah, right before we were captured, we were on the borderline, not knowing it, before we saw the guard. And he called saying, hey, I'm about to come your way. So, you know, let's coordinate. So you guys head down to the mountain and he'll head to, into the valley and we'll meet up. But, that didn't happen for about 26 months.
Hmm. No, a very long time. Since you each take turns writing sections of the book, you know, again, there's a Shane section, a Sarah section, a Josh section. Therefore, that gives the opportunity for great detail about sections of the book that certainly need a lot of detail and explanation. In particular, about the capture, the details are so crisp and fresh. I mean, I imagine that they're very fresh in your own mind still. Is that still the case?
Yeah, you know, like I said, that moment sort of poured over to my head as, like, as this critical moment. I mean, I was sitting in a solitary cell for 4 months, and I'm thinking, I can just feel around me, I'm being constantly punished. I can't talk to anybody. When I get caught sneaking notes out in the courtyard to somebody else, I get extra punished by being more isolated, because at that point, they were letting me see Shane and Sarah once a week, and then they cut that off when they caught me with notes. So it's like everything I was doing felt like, this sort of punishment. So I'm thinking, like, well, what could have I done to deserve this? And, think back onto, like, that hike, and it's absurd looking back. But I just went over it a million times and thought, oh, could we have done something different? Could we have not gone? Should we have, you know, this or that? And it's sort of, probably my favorite, the thing that I kept thinking about all the time was, could we just have ran? And then it would have been, who knows, they probably wouldn't have shot at us, but they might have.
Yeah, that's a real what if kind of moment. I can think about that myself. I mean, when you see the guy with the gun, it's like, how about we just run in the other direction, back the way we came?
Yeah, that is. Who knows what would happen?
Right. Josh Vital, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the book he co-wrote with his co-hikers in ultimately in Iran, Sarah Short and Shane Bauer, is called The Sliver of Light. So you found a water source that day. You found this waterfall and everything. Where in the world did you think you were? I mean, how far away? I mean, you knew the Iran border was nearby, but, I mean, how near did you think it was?
I mean, I didn't really have a sense. At one point, you know, I sort of asked my friends, how close we could be, and I think it was Shane who said, oh, maybe 100 kilometers or something. So I just took it at his word. You know, when we got detained at the border, they took us down the mountain, the other side. They put us in a truck. They took us down the mountain. And I remember they took us to a police station, and there was sort of this almost absurd interrogation. Of course, I was taking it very seriously. I didn't know what to expect. But they, they asked me to prove that I was Jewish by saying, spelling supercalifragilisticexpialidocious and this sort of thing. But they, you know, when it ended, they put me in a different, in another car, and they were going to send me to another police station in some other part of town. But I remember before I got in, there was one of the officials at the station, and he started going on and on about these Iranians who had been detained by the Americans for over 2 years. He kept repeating, oh, for 2 years, can you believe it? And he spoke a little English, and you know, he was kept saying 2 years. And I remember thinking, like, well, you know, first off, that's between the Iranian government and the U.S. government, and, you know, I don't stand for everything the U.S. government's doing, and that's between them to sort out. And then second off, 2 years, like, what does that have anything to, you know, that was just a few hours into, you know, just over 2 years for me later was what it took.
Yeah, well, that's what makes that moment kind of strange now in hindsight, is that he's talking about 2 years they kept these people in prison, and you were in for 2 years and 2 months.
Right.
Did you feel early on like a pawn in some big game between powers that really don't like each other, at least haven't gotten along with each other for more than 40 years?
You know, at first, that was, I kind of kept that from my head, that these governments are at odds, but I'm not, you know, they'll just sort this out. They'll just interrogate me, get to the truth, send me home, or send me, you know, back to Syria. After a couple months of interrogation, they said, look, my interrogator said, look, you know, you're not a spy, but this has become political. And so it's really up to your government, my government, to sort this out. And I felt this sort of, this feeling the whole time, like, you know, whether it's, you know, detaining these Iranian diplomats or, trying to, this international isolation, these efforts towards international isolation by the U.S. government. Support, you know, the U.S. government supported Saddam Hussein in the 80s to go after Iran. That this like history of hostility towards Iran, that if I were caught up in that, I wouldn't know how long it would take. I mean, that was decades. Even in 1953, the U.S. overthrew their democratically elected government to support their king, their Shah. And so I felt like if this is going to be between the governments, I don't know how long it would last.
And it did go on for 26 months. We're talking to Joshua Fatale about the book that he co-wrote with his fellow hikers, Imprisoned in Iran. It's called A Sliver of Light. Shane Bauer and Sarah Shore, the co-authors. You can talk to Josh here on the Jefferson Exchange at 541-552-6782. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I'm still curious about those first few moments, though. The guy with the gun, the soldier waving you toward him, and you comply because he has a gun. But what was there in the way of infrastructure? Was there a guard post? Was there a fence? Was there anything that indicated you had just, or were about to, as it turns out, cross into another country?
No, there's nothing indicated. I mean, when we got to the top of the ridge at that point, and when we saw the guard, the soldier took us just over, you know, sort of along the ridge a short ways, and there was like a little shack there. So at that point, there was a bunch of other guards kind of hanging out. It's a pretty remote outpost. You know, we were probably the most interesting thing that happened to them in a long time, showing up near their outpost. And you know, they were just kind of, when they saw us, they went through our bags and took our passports and wanted to, you know, see who we were, what we were about. But there was ultimately it was just that little shack that we couldn't see from before we hit the ridge.
Did you look like Americans? I mean, was it very clear to anybody in that part of the world that we were talking, you know, these are people from the United States of America?
You know, from the distance, is that what you mean? Could the guard have known?
Exactly.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I mean, well, I think, we look like ourselves and probably look pretty American, but I don't think he could have seen us that clearly. You know, he would have just seen these sort of three figures approaching, from, I don't know, a few hundred feet away, but it would have been clear that we didn't, there would have been no way to know we're American at that point. You know, I think to them, we were like a real, like I said, an oddity, and they didn't know what to do with us. Like when I talked about them moving us from police station to police station, it took them 3 days for them to ship us to Tehran in an 8-hour car ride to the capital, and that's, you know, that's where I spent the rest of the time, but you know, it was like it took them a while, and they were passing us off from one, you know, agency to the next, one group of officials to the next. It seemed like, you know, I was totally disoriented in those first days, but it seemed like they were pretty disoriented too.
As you look back on the situation now and with information you might have gained since the imprisonment, I mean, it sounds like this was just like, well, we caught these guys. They'd wandered over the border or close to the border anyway. So that they really didn't know what they'd had in the first place from the sounds of it. But after that, was it really, did you get a sense of it? This was a case where the people in charge were like, oh boy, now what do we do? Was it that sort of set of reactions?
Well, I mean, I think we were political currency to them. You know, they looked at us like, okay, the U.S. government has done, you know, X, Y, Z to us for how long, for how many decades, and now we got some retaliation. Mm-hmm. We have something to get back at them. And that was, you know, on one of those first car rides, one of the driver, the guy in the passenger seat, turned to us in the back seat and held one hand out and said, Iran, and then held his other hand out in the distance and said, America, and then just looked at us and said, problem. You know, there wasn't much language between us, but we could get those sort of things across. Mm-hmm. And so it was clear that this was a political issue. And so when I look back on it, it was like, boom, that was obvious from day one. But if I, you know, at the moment, I'm telling myself, like, okay, any moment now, I'm keeping some hope alive that this is going to be over, they're going to send us back, I won't have to really think about this anymore. But for them, I was political currency. And so as a prisoner, I became, you know, it took me a while to get this, but they couldn't hurt me in this way. They could only torture me without scars, which means psychological torture. So they, you know, I was in solitary for 4 months. And, you know, the UN now says 15 days can be considered torture.
Really? Okay, so 15 days and you were in for months. Wow.
So but they would do that, but they wouldn't hit me in this way. A couple of times when I got threatened or pushed around a little bit, guards like would come back looking like they were chastised from their superiors and would apologize. And it was this sort of crazy moments when I would hear apologies from the guards because that wasn't a normal dynamic. But like there was even one time when a guard they would beat their own prisoners more frequently. You know, there was regular interrogation, what we would call in America enhanced interrogation. Right. That's what they do there. And one of the times the guards were doing that to a prisoner very nearby, and it was when Shane and I were in a cell together, and we ran to the door, pounded on the door, kind of not fearful, because at that point, that was like a year and a half in, we knew we were valuable as hostages, and they wouldn't hurt us in this way. So we were pounding on the door, you know, trying to get the guard to stop. And the guard came to us being like, come on, what are you doing? And then we said, well, what is this, Guantanamo Bay? And because, you know, these are the guards that would always say to us when we would complain about conditions, they would say, well, what happens in Guantanamo? And we'd continue to complain, well, I haven't seen my lawyer, well, I haven't, you know, got a phone call home for 8 months, and it was only for 5 minutes, or whatever, all my complaints I had, they would say, no, don't worry, this is a hotel, 5-star, that's what they'd tell me. It was like across the board, the guards would say that. So when I told them, you know, you guys are acting like this is Guantanamo, they actually got so, one of the times they actually got so embarrassed and insulted by the idea that they stopped beating their own prisoner for it.
Really? They stopped beating their own... Wow, that's amazing. So there were beatings going on around you. Did that heighten the terror that something was going to happen to you physically?
Yeah, like I said, at first. I mean, I remember the first time I heard a beating. You know, it wasn't like an everyday thing, but it was occasional. And the first time was probably 2 or 3 weeks in. And I just remember I had my half hour in the courtyard. So I'm kind of in a solitary cell all day. It's like 10 by 14 feet. And for 2 half-hour sessions, I get to go to a courtyard, which is a little bit bigger. I'm not allowed see anybody or talk to anybody, and actually I have to have my blindfold on at this time, but I can jog back and forth like 20 feet in a line back and forth, and at one point I'm jogging back and forth blindfolded, but I can like look under the blindfold a little bit, and I hear this like really, really gruesome screaming, and at that point I remember I actually just totally stopped jogging and sat down in the middle of my path being like, you know, I didn't know what I was getting into, or what I had gotten into, and I had no idea if it would happen to me.
Yeah, that would have been a sobering moment for sure. You had mentioned being in solitary for a while. You mentioned just now, later on, being in a cell with Shane Bauer, your co-hiker and co-author. But early on, you were the first person separated out when Shane and Sarah were allowed to stay together, at least briefly. But you had pledged at some point to go on a hunger strike if you were separated?
Yeah, it was kind of the first thing we did. You know, it was like those first 3 days before we were taken to Tehran, before we were taken to the main prison there, Evin prison, we said, look, Shane, Sarah, and I said to each other, if they separate us, we go on hunger strike, because that's it. I mean, 10 times scarier to be alone in that situation than to have 2 other people. And they tore me apart from them and put them in solitary confinement cells also. But what they did is they put them in solitary confinement cells right next to each other, so they were actually able to speak through the vent for a month before they got moved. But for that immediate time, we all went on hunger strike. And it was about 5 days later, they let me have a 30-minute meal with them. Half blindfolded with the camera on us and 2 interrogators standing over us, but that was our win. But it wasn't really a win because we got thrown back into solitary, and so I went back on hunger strike. And after 6 more days of it, I didn't get to see my friends or be put with them, but they gave me a book, and that was the way. It was between the hunger and the book. They shut me up for a little bit,
Huh. So they were able to certainly push some buttons and pull some levers on you. The book is called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. Joshua Fatale, one of the authors, Sarah Short and Shane Bauer, the other authors, and Josh is with us on The Exchange. We'll come take a short break and return to The Exchange with Josh and with your phone calls and emails as well. But let me take another moment out here to remind you it is spring 2014 Fun to Drive time here on Jefferson Public Radio. We are trying to make sure that we can continue to provide program. Never get yourself to say to continue before 10 o'clock in the morning, but we will try to continue to provide programs like this for you as long as we can. We do that with your financial support. So please make that pledge call at 888-552-6191 or pledge online at ijpr.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Josh Fatale and A Sliver of Light in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Joshua Fatale. He is quite familiar with the Ashland and Cottage Grove areas, having spent a fair amount of time here, taking, among other things, a number of hikes. It was another hike he took in what he thought was Iraqi Kurdistan with a couple of friends that turned into imprisonment in Iran. That's the story that Josh Fatale tells with his partners Sarah Short and Shane Bauer in the book A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. It lasted for 26 months, starting in 2009. You can join us here in The Exchange as we talk about the experiences. One phone number available today, 541-552-6782. 541-552-6782. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So, you know, anybody, I'm sure, who is being detained thinks, oh, this will pass quickly. And I think you've already made references to that. And it ended up lasting for 26 months. Did you keep track of time? And if so, how?
I did. That was the first thing I had to figure out, was how to mark the days. Because after a few, you know, you start to lose, they all blur together. And there's nothing to mark time. It made me realize how much in everyday life we mark time by events and by things. So when nothing happens for day after day, it just becomes, very hard to differentiate the past. I found some little piece of religious ornament, actually, that it was somewhat chalk-like, so I was able to make these marks on my wall that lasted for most of the time and just counted the days. Sort of had this thing that, you know, with Shane and Sarah, I told them, you know, if we're going to make it through this, we're going to have some markers of time. We're going to have some rituals, some ceremonies. So we found like every way to celebrate, time. We started celebrating our half birthdays. Then we celebrated, because we got together, it was like New Year's, Iranian New Year's, which is 3 months later. We celebrated every holiday, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim that we could think of. And, you know, it was these things for us were time markers because we needed it. And we felt like finding some way to be positive, to try to think of some celebration of time was what got us through. Thinking about you mentioned at the opening that maybe we could call our book The Hike from Hell, we could have, but you know, we're trying to be optimistic here and call it at least a sliver of light, you know,
right,
little
at least
bit.
That much idea that the outside world existed, yes. So in the time you were in solitary, you mentioned that they played some games with you, but they finally gave you a book in response to one of your hunger strikes. Without that book, how were you occupying your time?
No, it wasn't. I don't know what I was doing. I was on the floor. I was just, like, using all my energy to, like, just lift myself up. I remember there was a fan on. It was summer when I was detained, and there was a fan on, and it drove me nuts. I would sit under the sink for hours at a time with my knees to my chest, my hands over my ears, just waiting for it to go off. I'd petition them to turn it off, and it would take hours. And I remember just, like, looking at the ants crawl across my cell and just watching them, their every move. I had one wrapper of a wafer that I ate, a wafer the day before I was detained, and it was in my pocket. And I would read the ingredients and memorize, try to figure out the Russian alphabet because they had Russian ingredients on it. Anything. I went through every day of my life. I tried to think about, every different year and memory of my life. It was just an effort to hold on to my sanity, and that's why solitary is, why it's considered torture, because it's like a constant effort to remember who you are. There's a saying I remembered from the place I was right before I was in prison, which was South Africa, on that study abroad program I spoke about, or as teaching assistant. It's called "People Are People Through Other People," and I felt that so much in prison that it was hard to even know myself, to see any reaction to myself without another person reflecting to me. When I hear, other people, that whole, usually in Iran, in that prison, the first thing they do to break everybody is they throw everyone in solitary. Oh. And it usually will last a few weeks to a few months or so. It seems to be the average, or the range, rather. It's just a horrific practice. And in America, it's a similar situation. It's not everybody who goes in prison gets it, but there's 80,000 people, and that, of course, is more than any place else in the world.
So with that kind of social deprivation, Josh, I mean, how did you respond to any human contact? I mean, when the guards would come by, when you weren't on hunger strike and they're just delivering food, would they talk to you? Could they talk to you? Did they know any English? I mean, so how did you respond when anybody came within your orbit?
Yeah, well, I'd do anything to sustain their attention because I felt like I needed some human contact. The guards would come by, and there was only a couple who spoke English, and I would, try to engage them in conversation, but they didn't want to talk to me. They're prison guards. They don't care for the prisoner. They had a little bit of curiosity about this American who was desperate for communication, but not much. I mean, it became this big, personal battle, in my head about whether to try to be nice. I was rooting for interrogation to come because that was somebody to talk to. It was something to write down my innocence. I could write it down and prove to myself because they weren't believing me, or they were pulling me along that I was innocent. But the battle myself was whether to be kind of a, just be demanding, like I was at the beginning with hunger striking and saying, this is what I need, I'll hurt myself if I don't get it, or try to be nice and try to say, I just really, would you please give me a few more books? Would you please let me see my friends? Would you please let me make a phone call? And I found that, I tried for so long to be nice, and then at a certain point, it just wasn't working. And we went on this sort of, after some months, went on a sort of sustained campaign of hunger striking to get letters. And it really worked. I mean, from the from that point on, they would bring letters with some regularity, and when they didn't, I'd go on hunger strike. And it was this sort of tough lesson that I had to stand up for myself. And I had to, kind of demand that the guard come back and, bring me the toothpaste that he's owed me for a week or whatever it was that I was asking for. It was like a fight, not literal physical fight, but a demand of rights. And it became this thing where, and Shane and Sarah were doing the same thing. So it became this just way of thinking that the only way I could get something is by demanding and by, forcing it, because that's the condition of prison, And it really wore on the relationships between Shane, Sarah, and I, where I could see between them two and then between me and Shane when we were in the cell for so long together, for 22 months, 10 by 14 feet, that I could see him kind of treating me that way. And then I'd find myself treating him that same way. And it was hard to break out of that,
Because if you're dealing with people that way on a regular basis, everybody you run into, you're going to treat the same way.
It seeps in, and we did our best to, just try to focus on, we're together, we're in this together, we were good friends before this. But that becomes a real tension, a real difficulty to relate to different people in very different ways.
How long were you guys in custody before you had any knowledge of what the outside world knew of you and had contact with people from the outside world who could at least carry your story out to the American authorities, for example?
Well, the real moment of recognition for me was after 2 months. The Swiss ambassador visited us, was allowed to visit the prison. And so there's one day I'm in solitary confinement for 2 months at this point, totally, like, don't even know if, like, my family knows. And they take me to see the Swiss ambassador for a half hour. And she tells us that we've been on CNN, and it's a big deal, and that my family cares about me, and they know about me, they know where I am. And it was kind of like all these fears I had that I'd been forgotten, that no one even knew, that I was just missing, started to allay. But really, you know, I think that was a kind of when I first, like, realized, but there's this inertia or this, like, downward energy in prison where you don't, if I'm not constantly reminded, I'm constantly in this, there's no, with no letters, with few letters and few phone calls, I had to, I would get a letter and I'd get really excited that so many people cared, and then I'd forget about it. It would be like, well, they probably forgot about me. And it would, you know, it's kind of, when dealing, this is something, and I've spoken to prisoners in America since being out, it's like, you need constant support. It's not just like a one-time thing. Yeah, like a regular communication, or else the whole, like, kind of institutional setup of a prison is to make you a forgotten entity, and to make you, it's like a social death.
Is life back to normal for you now, Josh Fatale? Can it be back to normal after 26 months in prison in Iran?
I don't know whose life is back to normal. No one's life is ever normal. Life's pretty normal. It's moved on. It's not like it was before prison. I definitely wasn't giving interviews that frequently before I was detained. That's a new thing. Writing a book was a new thing. But writing the book itself was this big process and turning point for me, you know. It took a year and a half, really, of, like, pretty regular, almost every day, really, writing. And when I closed the book, so to say, last summer, it felt like, and actually I was outside of Ashland when I finished it up. And when I had that point, I felt like I was really starting to put it behind me and could move on to do other things. Within a few months, I was moving to New York. I had a child. I started school, and I feel like I've kind of moving on to the new normal of life. There's sort of a kind of living with this sense that there's 2.3 million in the U.S., but more millions internationally that are kind of in this institution to dehumanize people, that's like what its purpose is, mm-hmm. one of its main purposes, kind of drags on me, and the numbers, you know, these numbers of 80,000 in solitary is kind of unfathomable, some of them in for decades. There's other things like the, you know, this whole nuclear negotiation stuff with Iran. When that's in the news, like, it tends to be, I'll lose some sleep over it, and it's not something I used to lose sleep over before, but I lose sleep thinking, hoping that the two countries can kind of come to some resolution so that the political situation is resolved and doesn't continue to put people in danger like I was.
Well, that's a real wait-and-see game, but we certainly have a happy ending to your story up to a point. A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran, Shane Bauer, Sarah Short, and Josh Fatale. Josh Fatale's been our guest. Thank you so much for joining us, Josh.
Well, thank you, Jeffrey.
You bet.